This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's news magazine for Friday, May 29th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us. Coming up this week,
it started rocking and rolling in that school, and all those kids are really trained well to duck under a table, and that's exactly what they did.
A 6.4 magnitude earthquake rattled southwest Alaska residents before bed last night. We'll check in with one resident from Chignik Lagoon about the effects there. Some folks in Naknek say the new Trident fishmeal plant was a little stinky during its test run with herring.
I could actually smell it inside my house, and that was not very pleasant.
We'll check in with a special legislative session in Anchorage where lawmakers are trying to fund the state's budget ahead of any layoffs. A retiring teacher shares a few thoughts and stories with us, and we'll ask whether those recently released wood bison will ever happen down the Bristol Bay watershed. And a pebble case, a third this week, has been resolved.
I'm not a lawyer, but all I know is it's a good day for Bristol Bay. It's good for us.
Those stories and more coming up after a look back at some of the week's news. A 6.42 magnitude earthquake struck about 80 miles northeast of the Chignik's last night at 11 p.m. sharp. The quake, which many reported lasting 30 seconds or more, was felt all over southwest Alaska and reportedly as far away as Wasilla. Near to the epicenter, Alvin Peterson in Chignik Lagoon said it was the strongest he's felt in decades.
Well, it was almost comparable to the 64 earthquake. It was house was rocking pretty good. I understand there were some rock slides and stuff falling off the shelves and breaking, and definitely rattled everybody's nerves.
Residents in Chignik Bay, closer to the coast, made for the tsunami shelter, but no tsunami warning was issued. A dozen or more smaller earthquakes have happened near to last night's on through this morning. No major damage or injuries have yet been reported. On Tuesday evening, a Cessna 206 with three on board ran out of fuel mid-flight and crashed in the mountains north of Lake Clark. The three survived the emergency landing, activated their personal locator beacon, and State Trooper Joe Minnick from Iliamna launched in search.
They were reportedly flying somewhere between 4,500 and 5,000 feet when their aircraft ran out of fuel. They were en route to Port Allsworth to refuel. Anyway, the aircraft ran out of fuel, and the pilot opted the mountaintop as the best location for his emergency landing.
Trooper Minnick located the site and radioed in the location. The RCC at J-Bear rescued the men off the mountain using a Pave Hawk helicopter and a C-130. All three were taken to Iliamna and declined further medical attention. In a federal courtroom in Anchorage yesterday, Judge H. Russell Holland heard arguments from Pebble and the EPA as to whether or not he should dismiss Pebble's FACA lawsuit against the agency. Pebble alleges EPA officials used anti-Pebble activists as advisors without following federal procedures. The dismissal of a separate federal case was upheld Thursday by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and today word that Alaska's Supreme Court has overturned a previous ruling in a case that challenged whether Alaska's DNR had to offer public notice for certain mineral exploration activities. It was widely reported that after Pebble had won that case, the company had sent its legal bills to plaintiffs Nunamta Lukastai, Vic Fisher, and Bella Hammond. Now that the case has been overturned, those bills should be dropped. The first halibut of the season arrived in Dillingham's Boat Harbor Tuesday afternoon, fetching $7 a pound, with no shortage of eager customers scooping up the fresh catch.
We had 25 in here, and the biggest one was 71 pounds.
Okay, and what are the smaller ones like?
Smallest we had was 12 pounds.
That was Mike Johnson, a crewman aboard the Eagle II, speaking with KDLG News. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration noted that this has officially been the wettest May on record for Bristol Bay. According to meteorologist Joe Wegman, 3.32 inches of rain had been recorded at the King Salmon Weather Station by Tuesday.
And of course, there's still a week left in May, and I think our forecast continues to say rain. So it only looks like over the next week they'll continue to add to that record.
The National Weather Service had warned of rising river levels in Bristol Bay. On our crime and safety beat, an employee of Trident Seafood's Acatan plant was found dead Wednesday. 30-year-old Juliana Zazueka of Bakersfield, California, did not show up for work Tuesday, and after an extensive search was found the next day. Troopers say no foul play was suspected. A Bethel woman, 23-year-old Eunice Whitman, was found murdered Sunday, her body stashed in bushes near a park. Her boyfriend, 24-year-old Justin Paul, is the prime suspect and is in custody, but Bethel police now say they're looking for a second man who might have also been involved. And former Dillingham Police Department drug dog Lutri made news this week after he helped troopers find roughly $350,000 worth of pot and hash oil in shipments bound for Southeast Alaska. Lutri now works for the Trooper Post in Ketchikan. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. I'm Dave Benninger. Thanks for staying with us today. Well, Alaska and Alaskans are certainly not unfamiliar with earthquakes, but last night's 6.4 magnitude quake caught many across the southwest part of the state a little bit surprised. It happened at 11 p.m. sharp, just as many were settling in for the evening. Its epicenter was nearest to the Chignik communities, and we spoke with some of those residents there this morning. Joining me now is Nancy Anderson, a lifelong resident of Chignik Lagoon. Nancy, we're glad to have you on the program today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, take me back to last night just before 11 o'clock. Where were you and what was happening down in Chignik Lagoon before?
Well, I had gotten done taking a long hike with my girls, and then we went and cleaned out the smokehouse, and they had ice cream at Grandma's house. So I decided to take them to the school and run a little bit of CMOF. And we were there just checking on things at the school and making sure everything is locked down. And it started rocking and rolling in that school, and it was funny because all those kids are really trained well to duck under a table, and that's exactly what they did. They ran for cover, and so it rocked and rolled for a few minutes and or a few seconds, I guess, and then it kind of stopped, and we thought, okay, it's over. But then it just started right back up with just as much strength as before. So I was kind of watching the paper towel rolls bounce from one side of the paper towel container to the other side of the container. And so as soon as it kind of calmed down a little bit, we jumped in the car and ran from my parents' house, which is a lot higher ground than my house is. And we hung out there for a little bit and connected with the internet and just kind of checked to see if there were any tsunami warnings. After we stayed there for about 45 minutes or so, we decided it was safe to go home. We hadn't heard of any tsunami warnings. And we came home to broken blueberry syrup from the falling off the pantry shelves, and my clock had fallen off the wall and broke, and we had messes to clean up all over the place.
Oh, well, it sounds like it could have been worse. I don't want to make light of it. But also, were you surprised there were no tsunami warnings from the quake last night?
Yeah, I definitely was. I'm not exactly sure as to why, because usually we get something, you know, some sort of warning or, you know, advisory, something like that, but there was nothing.
Did others sort of make for high ground in Lagoon? You're a little bit away from the coast, but I imagine if a tsunami was strong enough, you'd really have some effects there.
Well, we have a sand spit in the lagoon. We have a sand spit that kind of stretches out to the opening of the lagoon, and we're pretty protected by that. If a wave did come, I'm pretty sure it would break it. The village has often tried to get funding for a tsunami center, but that was one of the reasons why we've been able to get funding, is because we're pretty protected. But yeah, some people did go for higher ground, and it was pretty exciting. Everybody was on the phone talking to each other, and just touching base and making sure everybody else is okay. It's one of those times that the community really comes together.
Well, that's good to hear. Nancy, how did last night's quake stand out in your mind compared to other quakes you've experienced through your life? A caller earlier today compared this one to 1964.
Well, I wasn't alive in 64.
Of course.
So, you know, when I don't know why, but I remember third grade really, really well. And it was like we were having an earthquake once a week in third grade. But yeah, I've been through some strong earthquakes. I think there was a 7.1 at one point down this way. But, you know, we survive. We're strong.
Tell me how your girls responded. Were they thrilled and excited or frightened, or what was their general response last night?
You know, at first they did exactly what they've been trying to do all those years in school. They ran for the tables and they got underneath door frames, and we had four of them. And then I had another teenager who was kind of hanging out with us too. And he was probably the most scared. He's like, I'm out of here. And he ran out of the building, and then he ran back in. He's like, come on, you guys. So it was kind of comical, but
Well, we won't name him. Let's not name him here.
No, I won't. but the girls, my girls did, you know, they got under tables. And I have two little ones, a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, and they were probably the most scared. We had to kind of put headphones in one little girl's ear so that she wouldn't listen to the after talk, you know, how everybody is excitedly talking about, you know, tsunamis and things like that. And we were afraid of nightmares. So we put headphones in her ears and just kind of held her and tried to calm her down a little bit. But it was scary for them.
I imagine it was. Well, good news that so far no reports of any major damage or injuries from last night's earthquake. Nancy Anderson in Chignik Lagoon, thank you so much for coming on the program to tell us more about it from the closer location you were at last night.
Sure, no problem. Thanks for calling.
We turn now to Naknek, where some residents are saying they're not immediately impressed by Trident Seafood's new fish meal plant. The multi-million-dollar facility, built to settle alleged violations of the Clean Water Act, may be the future for salmon processing in Bristol Bay, but when it began operating for the first time during the recent Togiak herring season, the smell was stronger than expected. Some residents say they're hoping something changes before the salmon season. KDLG's summer fisheries reporter Molly Dishner has more.
There were days where the plant was in operation where I could actually smell it inside my house as well, and that was not very pleasant.
That was Bill Hill, one of the Naknek residents who could smell the new fish meal plant when it was processing herring this spring. He's also the superintendent of the school and said it could be smelled there, too. Borough Assembly member Russell Phelps said he fielded complaints from several residents in the area who could smell the plant. He called Trident and says he was told that the plant wasn't completely finished when it started operating this spring.
The building wasn't 100% complete, so I know that there was some internal issues that caused the plant to not operate the way it was supposed to operate.
Phelps says once some work at the new plant is done, there should be less of an odor. Hill says he hopes the plant will be tweaked to reduce the smell, but he's still supportive of it.
I think anything that extends our fishing seasons should be welcome. I'm a big proponent of industry in our area.
Hill says he's also glad to see processors using a larger portion of the fish.
We just chop up tons and tons of protein and throw it into the water. That's what we do now. And finding a way to use that product, I think, is probably environmentally conscious and also a good use of something that's very valuable.
Phelps says other processors have mentioned that they may want to build their own plants, but the borough may look at putting more requirements on them in the future.
I think it's all going to play out here in the next 10 years, and I could say that there's a possibility that there's going to be more meal plants than just one.
In the meantime, he hopes the town will smell a little better this summer once work at the plant is finished.
I think it is going to end up smelling somewhat, but I don't think it's going to smell as bad as it did during herring season.
In Naknek, I'm Molly Dishner.
And Molly Dishner has been hired as our fisheries reporter for the summer and will work for us through August, covering many of the interesting stories out there in Bristol Bay. And she joins me now from somewhere on a recent assignment. Hi, Molly, and where are you at this morning?
We're in a boatyard in Naknek, looking at the Jenny O'Don right now.
All right. So what's the activity preseason here on the east side of Bristol Bay? It always spins up a little bit faster over there.
People are starting to get into town and get some work done on their boats. I think there's more happening with businesses in the town itself than the fishermen so far. I just talked to one guy who said he thinks a lot more people start showing up next week around the first, second of June.
Okay. And where are we sending you off to this weekend, and what stories are you bringing back?
This afternoon I'm headed to Igiagig to do a story on their smolt counting project. So the researchers there are looking at how many smolts are leaving the lake and the river and headed back into the bay.
Well, it sounds like an interesting assignment for you, and we're glad that you're out there and bringing those back to us next week. We look forward to hearing more from you as we get our Bristol Bay Fisheries Report underway starting Monday night.
Sounds good.
You You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Yesterday, there was news on two federal lawsuits filed by Pebble against the EPA. The earlier dismissal of one case was upheld by an appeals court, and oral arguments were heard on whether or not to dismiss a second case. Judge H. Russell Holland in Anchorage promised a decision on that motion to dismiss in the near future. As long as that case remains open, the Environmental Protection Agency has been ordered not to take any further action restricting mining activity like Pebble in the Bristol Bay watershed. But this morning, another case involving Pebble also made news. The Alaska Supreme Court reversed a lower court's earlier ruling in favor of Pebble and the state of Alaska that had held public notice need not be given for some mineral exploration. The plaintiffs in the case are Rick Delkitty, Violet Wilson, Vic Fisher, Bella Hammond, and Nunamta Alukastai. Kim Williams is the director of Nunamta, and she joins me now. Kim, thanks for coming on again.
Oh, thank you, Dave.
So tell me what this ruling means for this case, and how are you receiving it today?
Well, we're extremely happy that the Supreme Court has reversed the Superior Court's decision on Pebble Mine's exploration up at the Pebble site and how the state of Alaska handled the permitting for those temporary land use permits up there, and now they have to allow public notice. And so for Bristol Bay people, we're extremely happy because it's a big step. I mean, we always wanted a process to talk about and to give our input about the drilling, the 1,200 drill sites up there, and we were shut out. And so our only recourse was to take them to court. And, you know, it's been a long time coming, but...
Well, the initial ruling was not in favor. That's why this went to the Supreme Court, correct?
Right. It wasn't in favor, and Pebble basically tried to go after Vic Fisher and Bella Hammond, and that was in the papers, you know, not about a year ago, I want to say.
Well, let's reiterate that Bella Hammond and Vic Fisher were on the lawsuit along with Nunamta and some other folks, and explain why Pebble came after them.
Well, they came after them for attorney costs because they won in Superior Court and basically said, we have every right to our attorney fees, and, you know, we have over $1 million of attorney fees, and we have every right to go after them. And we had to appeal it. We really felt that the exploration activities up there required some public notice by the state, and in the end, the Supreme Court agreed with us, and the attorney fees granted us attorney fees, which all has to be figured out in the end, but we're just happy to know that the state has to follow a process. We'll have to develop a process that allows public input.
Well, it has certainly been a busy week for lawsuits regarding Pebble, the state of Alaska, the EPA, and the rest. Do you have it all sorted out at this point, or do you need a few days to digest?
No, I think we all need the weekend to digest. I'm not a lawyer and can't figure out all of the legalese related to these cases. But all I know is it's a good day for Bristol Bay. It's good for us.
Kim Williams is the director of Nunamta Alukastai. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Back in a moment. Lost track yet of what's happening with your state legislature? We admit that we are. Things may change today, but right now, Alaska's lawmakers are meeting in Anchorage, and they've yet to agree on how to fund the state's operating budget. Governor Walker has said layoff notices for state employees could go out as soon as next week, and agencies may start scaling back their operations as well. The Republican majority and the Democrats in the minority are at odds on some priorities, as well as where to take several billion dollars to pay for this year. District 37 Representative Bryce Edgman spoke with me earlier this morning for an update. Hi, Bryce. Thanks for coming back on.
Yes, Dave. It's my pleasure to finally be able to connect with you and to talk a little bit about what's happening here in special session.
As I'm sure things might change today, but perhaps you can provide an update this morning. Where are we at in these budget funding negotiations at this point? And the deadline's drawing near. Will state employees get layoff notices? Are agencies going to close down? Perhaps you can bring us up to speed a bit.
Well, what I can say today, May 29th, Friday, is that we are making a headway. We're finally making some progress. What that ultimately is going to materialize into, of course, we will see. We have some unprecedented budget shortfalls, and we also have some extremely disparate points of view in terms of adding a small amount of money into the budget and people's feeling on tapping the earnings fund reserve, transferring the permanent fund earnings reserve money into the corpus of the fund itself and what that would mean long term. So trying to negotiate through all of those differences. And
what are the options you can support at this time? And perhaps tell me about the letter that you signed as well here.
Yes, myself, along with five other House Majority colleagues, sent a letter to the Speaker of the House saying that we had grave concerns with doing anything with a permanent fund at this point without it first going out to the vote of the Alaska people, and two, without it undergoing rigorous analysis.
So you do support taking savings from the Constitutional Budget Reserve, which requires that three-quarters vote, but not for borrowing from the or taking from the permanent fund to pay for this year's operating budget.
That's exactly right. And the reason I support going into the CBR and using the three-quarters vote is that's the process that it was intended for. I believe we can make small concessions to minority Democrats and others in the Senate, get the agreement we need, and if we have to, at a later time, look at the permanent fund earnings reserve, I support first starting with Governor Walker's statewide forum in early June to look comprehensively at Alaska's fiscal path going forward. And that's what I think needs to happen before we touch anything involved with the permanent fund at this point.
When will we expect to see a vote? If it requires three-quarters vote to pass, when will that vote happen?
Well, it could happen as soon as today. In the House, and then the Senate, I'm told they're having a number of their members coming into Anchorage today, and they could act tomorrow, conceivably, if everything went according to a best-case scenario. And if everything were to sort of fall in the line, we could be done here in a day or two.
Well, Representative Bryce Edgman, speaking with us from Anchorage Friday morning, is what appears to be yet another busy day for this special session. Thanks for making the time, and glad to have you on the program again, Bryce.
David, as always, it's been my pleasure.
We can't help but enjoy the story of Alaska's effort to repopulate the wild interior with wood bison. Back in April, 100 cows, bred in captivity, were flown to the Yukon River village of Shagaluk and released. Some were pregnant and have given birth, some died, but the Department of Fish and Game says overall things are off to a good start. But there's an obvious missing piece to this Garden of Eden story. Well, this week the department put 12 big, burly bull bison on a raft, now riverbound, for that herd of eager cows. I've been really trying, baby. All right, maybe we're dreaming, but we just can't help but think one of these days some of those wood bison will come traipsing over the rivers and through the woods and end up on the rifle sights of some Bristol Bay hunters. KDLG's Hannah Colton explored that for this report.
As the crow flies, or the wood bison trots, Shagaluk is about 215 miles from Killigannik, the nearest Bristol Bay community. Bigger than their plains cousins, wood bison are North America's largest land animal. A single bull might yield a hunter up to 1,100 pounds of take-home meat. And that meat, according to one Canadian bison farmer, is delicious. Del Myers has a herd of 70 bison outside Prince George, B.C.
And we quite enjoy eating our own product as well.
What is the meat like? How would you compare it to beef, say?
One of the most interesting comments we had at the farmer's market was from a lady who said, after I asked her about bison meat, she said, "It tastes like I wish beef tasted like. I'd say it's more flavorful than beef, but a nice flavor."
And it's not just farmers markets. Canadian lodges now offering wood bison hunting trips boast large trophies and happy clients. The question is, will the wood bison ever make it to Southwest Alaska? I called wildlife biologist Neil Barton at Fish and Game in Dillingham to find out. Hi, Neil. So based on what you know of wood bison and how they range, what do you think are the chances that the herd over by Shagaluk would make their way down into the Bristol Bay area?
Well, I'm not a wood bison expert by any means, but if you look at the other bison herds, which are plains bison we have scattered around the state at Farewell and Chitna, those places, they're fairly sedentary, I think, because of the habitat requirements they have. And I would expect these wood bison, they were put in a place that they can hopefully thrive because of the habitat that's available to them.
His best guess is that they'll probably stay put.
I think they're going to be pretty much sticking to the habitat there that they're utilizing in that, you know, specific area where they were dumped off would be my guess anyway.
All right. So maybe we won't be drawing permits for wood bison out of Bristol Bay anytime soon. Putting the meat issue aside for the moment, this reintroduction project is an impressive undertaking. Fairbanks-based wildlife biologist Kathy Harms says this may be the largest wood bison reintroduction ever attempted.
Canada has established several herds, and to my knowledge, none of them have involved as many animals as we're moving.
She says Alaska has huge stretches of rich habitat for wood bison, and the bison are a crucial part of that habitat, mowing and fertilizing the grasses and sedges they graze.
The physical disturbance of the hooves on the grass affect how the grass grows and how productive it is. They've even done studies in Canada that link nest success with how much wood bison fur is used by the birds, the ducks, to create the nests. The nests are warmer because the wood bison hair is so insulating.
But wood bison have been extinct from the state for a long time. Harm says the last wild Alaskan wood bison may have been seen in the early 1900s.
So they've been gone for at least 100, if not 200 or more years. So having a chance to actually put a piece back has been really gratifying.
Biologists have been wanting to do this for a long time, but it wasn't until 2003 that wood bison from Canada were brought to a wildlife center in Anchorage, waiting for the day when they could be returned to natural habitat. By 2015, the herd was finally ready. But given all the great bison digs in Alaska, how to choose where to release them? Harms says the lower Innoko Yukon River area stood out.
Not only because of the terrific habitat that's there, but tremendous support from the local people.
The plan they came up with? It calls for hunting as soon as the herd is big enough to withstand harvest. And how long Alaskan hunters have to wait? Well, that's for nature to decide. Right now, there's a dozen bulls on a barge and 16 more behind them, on their way to wild grasses and 50 lady bison. Breeding season starts in July. For KDLG, I'm Hannah Colton.
Before we go this week, a final conversation. Schools in Dillingham let out for the summer last week, marking a joyous three-month break for many of the students, but the end of the school year is more bittersweet for a retiring school teacher. Ina Bowker retired from the Dillingham City School District after 30 years of teaching. Bowker was raised in Manicotic and has taught a bicultural class now for decades, instilling Yupik traditions and language in hundreds of students over the years. She recently sat down with KDLG's Matt Martin to share some memories of the past three decades.
Thanks for joining me today, Ina.
You're very welcome.
You know, looking back on your career and your life here in Dillingham, you know, over 30 years, I just imagine you go to the store and see all your former students around.
Well, you know, I am so grateful I have been able to teach many of my present students, moms and dads. And when I go into a kindergarten class on the first day of school with them, I sit them in a circle and I look at each student and I ask them, oh, who do you look like? And usually right on the spot, I'll say, I bet you your mom is, or I'll say, I bet you your dad is, because of the resemblance. And they will look up at me with great big eyes and they'll say, oh, how did you know? And I'll say to them, because I had your mom in my second grade classroom or first grade classroom many, many years ago.
I was told to ask about your time selling Tupperware in Maine.
Yes, I did. I did sell Tupperware in Maine. And the community heard somehow after I did my first housewarming thing with Tupperware, our house selling. Yeah, you guys got to invite this Eskimo lady. She tells really good stories. And so I was booked solid for a whole month, I remember.
Most successful Tupperware salesman in Maine.
Yes, I was.
And so I also wanted to ask you about the work that you've done with the bilingual or bicultural classes here that you've been doing in Dillingham. So, I mean, is that something that you hope that, you know, you can maybe be an inspiration for students from this area to come back and, like yourself, you know, be a teacher that's from this area who can teach the culture and the language of this area back to the people that live here?
That would be so awesome if we could have many of our students come back and become teachers, because they know the culture, they know the environment, they know family, they know the community. Everything about that is so important as a teacher.
So, I mean, what are your thoughts as you start this new chapter of your life?
Well, it has and is still so emotional for me. Matter of fact, for the first 3 days after I turned in my letter to the superintendent, I cried. Cried for 3 days. So on the second night, my husband said to me, if this retirement thing is making you this sad, just call the superintendent and tell him you changed your mind. And I said to him, but today was the deadline at 4 p.m. He said, today's not over. You have 4 more hours. That made me smile. And every time I walked into the classroom after that, I would have tears. And every morning I had to redo my makeup because I would be crying as I was driving to work. I'm not exactly sure what to think about this next chapter in my life, because teaching and being in school is what I have done since I was 5 or 6 years old. All these years, and it has been my life. I have thoroughly loved my job, and I will look back on my time at Dillingham City Schools with many, many wonderful memories.
Well, Ina, I think it's going to be a big loss for the students of Dillingham to not have you around anymore. But I thank you for coming in and sharing some of your stories and experiences with us.
You're very welcome.
And you can listen to Matt's full interview with Ina Bowker at our website, kdlg.org. Well, that's it for this week's Bristol Bay and Beyond. Send news tips, stories, story ideas, songs, and poems to news@kdlg.org. I'm Dave Benninger in Dillingham, predicting that by this time next week, most of us will have been bitten by a mosquito, many of us will have landed a first salmon, and a few of us will have already started looking forward to next winter. Goodbye.